Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 139 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, presented by the iconic Empire Hotel on New York's Upper West Side. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the greatest Australian actors of all time, an Oscar winner for 1996's Shine, an Emmy winner for 2004's The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, and a Tony winner for 2009's Exit the King, the great Jeffrey Rush. Rush, who is now 65, has had a most unusual career. He worked in the Australian theater as a character actor almost entirely under the radar until he was well into his 40s, at which point he was offered the starring role in the tiny Aussie indie Shine, Scott Hicks' biopic of the schizophrenic pianist David Helfgott. Largely because of his performance, the film became an international sensation, and he took home not only an Oscar, but also Golden Globe, SAG, BAFTA, Critics' Choice, New York Film Critics Circle, and LA Film Critics Association awards, cementing his reputation as an actor of the first order. Over the ensuing years, he garnered three more Oscar nominations: for his supporting performance in the Best Picture Oscar winner for 1998, Shakespeare in Love, for his leading performance in 2000's Quills, and for his supporting performance in the Best Picture Oscar winner for 2010, The King's Speech. He has also played the key supporting part of Barbossa in the Pirates of the Caribbean film franchise, which has encompassed four of the biggest blockbusters of all time, with a fifth on the way. His latest project, Genius, is in some ways unlike any he has undertaken before. It's a 10-part limited series, the first scripted show ever put on the air by National Geographic, in which he plays the older of two versions of Albert Einstein. And though its first episode, which was directed by Ron Howard, doesn't debut until Tuesday, April 25th, critics and pundits, including yours truly, already have gotten an early look at it and several other episodes, and I can tell you that Rush is at the top of his game. Over the course of our conversation at the Empire Hotel, Rush and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them what it was like being thrust with the success of Shine into fame and fortune after years of having neither, what factored into his decision to do a TV movie in The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, at a time when actors who had made their name in movies rarely agreed to do anything related to television, what the series of fateful events were that led to him reading the script that would become The King's Speech and learning a great deal about the little-known speech therapist he agreed to play in it, what most appealed to him about playing, in Genius, an iconic man everyone knows of but few know much about, for a network that had never made anything like it before, and much more. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. To begin with, we always begin by asking, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in a town up on the Darling Downs, which is like 80 miles west of Brisbane, the capital of Queensland in Australia. And my mum was a shop assistant in a kind of like department store. And my dad was an accountant in the Air Force.
Talk about the cultural landscape in Australia when you were growing up, because from what I've been able to gather, wasn't yet much of a film industry.
No.
TV came there a bit later.
Yeah.
So for somebody who clearly had artistic inclinations, I think, from an early age. Where did that come from, and what could you do with it?
Yeah, it felt like a bleak wasteland. But, you know, when I look back, literally the film industry had been dead since the 1930s. We had a really fertile, active film industry from the late 1890s onwards, because the Lumiere brothers came out with their kinematograph and filmed the Melbourne Cup, which is like our big Southern Hemisphere Kentucky Derby. It's the big horse race. And that really fired people's imaginations, and we lay claim to having created the first probably feature-length dramatic film in 1905, 1906, the story of Ned Kelly. He was a bushranger, outlaw, Jesse James kind of equivalent, you know. And by the 30s, we were flourishing, you know. And then, sorry to say, American distribution kind of overtook the world, and our industry became completely moribund. Very rare. Occasionally, an English film production might do some Australiana kind of theme. But, and it really only kick-started again in the mid-70s, kind of in the wake of the first wave of people that mostly came out of the newly established film and TV school.
Yeah.
You know, that was the kind of the Peter Weirs, Gillian Armstrongs, Phil Noyce kind of era. But for me, growing up in Toowoomba, you know, I'm old enough now to remember the dying days of travelling vaudeville tent shows. Makes me sound like I'm 120. Oh,
well, they lasted there longer, though. They were gone.
They just survived, like, within a year or two, they were gone. They, you know, they had this magnificent, like, maybe 800, 1,000-seat tent with a canvas proscenium arch stage down one end. And by night, they would do variety acts and magicians and blue comedians, very risque adult humor. And then by day they'd do like an English style but a very Australian pantomime for kids. I was enthralled by that. And then I remember at around about the age of 7 or 8, before we made the move to Brisbane, which was a much bigger city, I would see local amateur musical theatre productions like Oklahoma. So I felt there was a surfeit of like an extremely vibrant theatrical culture going on in my life. But technically, if you look back, there was one major national musical theatre commercial outfit that toured, you know.
And you just kept
Dolly
saying them. My understanding is that you really, I guess in a way, went all in as far as doing this stuff yourself senior year of high school. What happened there? A few things, right, that kind of solidified this trajectory.
Yes. Academically, I did okay in high school. And at the age of 10, I was besotted with the American space program, the Mercury program, then Gemini, then the Apollo. That was as significant to me through my high school years as the surf music coming in from California or the Mersey sound coming in from Britain. We were kind of sandwiched between these two great, you know, youthquake moments in pop culture. So I went to the vocation guidance officer and said, you know, I'd really want to be an astronomer. I used to give lectures in year 7. I don't know what about the solar system, and I'd have maps and all this sort of stuff.
Wow.
How and why books, you know, they were kind of cosmology for dummies. The equivalent of that, you know. And he said, you'll need chemistry and physics and advanced mathematics. And I went, great. And I did that. And by years 11 and 12, I was hopeless. once the slide rule had to come out, that and once calculus entered into the equation, it just, my brain did not process.
I very much understand that, yes.
But at the same time, fortunately, I'd also been doing a lot of school plays. You know, every year we would put on something. And for whatever reason, in years 11 and 12, the women who had kind of nurtured us into the school drama club, they either got married or got transferred or whatever, and we just decided as students that we would run it ourselves. So I was the director of the company in year 12. doing groundbreaking work like arsenic and old lace.
Yeah. But this, when you say year 12, just are we saying basically the year before you would go off to university?
Yeah. Okay. That was my senior year of high school. Gotcha. And then I went to university and changed to a Bachelor of Arts degree and studied literature and drama.
And as you headed off to university, what did you imagine you would actually be doing with your future?
I didn't know. I was time filling. Yeah. And I thought, you know, the generic broad education. And it was still in an era where the university felt like a kind of separated enclave from the rest of the world. You could actually just go and indulge in study. And it felt great after the pressures of high school because you'd turn up to lectures. But I was quite a keen student because I was hungry for, you know, I was doing psychology and anthropology and a lot of arts literary subjects.
Was there also a bit of a radical streak there?
This was 69 to 71. So, yeah, it was right in the center of that great countercultural kind of swing.
And that even extended into the theater.
And the campus was like the hub within Brisbane, you know.
So even as you continued to be involved with theatrical stuff, that impacted that as well, right? You were not just doing, you know, Oklahoma at the university.
Oh, no. We were doing, you know, radical kind of political reviews, and there'd be a mixture of the artsy people on campus would be there with the Trotskyites,
right.
And they'd be with, you know what I mean? It was quite a heady mix.
So what was it that happened while you, I think, were still in university that led to your first professional opportunities here for several years?
Well, I was in a number of, I suppose, you know, there were radical classical reinterpretations of things like Ibsen's Peer Gynt. And then in the reviews, you know, there'd always be nudity for laughs, you know, like that. And during that time, the director of the newly formed Queensland Theatre Company, which was a major state regional repertory company, mm-hmm. set up, he came to see that in that show where I was running around naked and whatever. And I always like to say he thought there was a big future in front of me. I don't know. But I literally did my last exam for my Bachelor of Arts on a Friday. And on the Monday morning, I was on a 3-year contract to go into the theater. So I didn't have any anxiety about what am I going to do with this degree. I just thought, well, this is practical.
And what did the people around you, I guess your parents, other people, what did they make of this? You're now actually doing it.
Well, my mum has always been outrageously supportive and just said, if that makes you happy, great.
That's nice.
And she comes and sees everything I do.
Mm-hmm.
She's about to turn 90 this year, and she's in good shape.
That's great. Terrific.
Yeah.
And your dad, was he still around in the picture at that point?
No, they divorced when I was quite young.
I gotcha. Mm. So you did that for the 3 years. How do you then wind up in England and France, and what was the value of that going forward?
There was a kind of interstate rivalry. I don't know. Like, did New York and Chicago have a kind of unspoken rivalry?
Or Boston
relation?
And New York.
Boston and New York, that sort of thing. There was kind of that between anything to do with Queensland and the southern states, as we disparagingly called Sydney and Melbourne. So I did 3 years at that company, and the inevitable path would have been to go to our National Institute, NIDA, which, you know, produces great actors. Cate Blanchett studied there much later, of course. But because I'd done 3 years, 8 plays a year in this sort of repertory-style company, I felt trained enough to kind of make a sideways step. And I'd done a workshop with this guy who'd studied under this great French teacher, Jacques Lecoq, which is a kind of movement and mimetic-based course. And I went to a workshop that he ran in Brisbane once, and he said, you've got a really good feel for this. I'd strongly recommend you go there because it is it will tap into your distinctive creativity. He doesn't really turn out a kind of prescribed product, you know. I mean, at different times, you know, people like Julie Taymor have studied at that school, and Mnuchin, who's a great French director, and actors like Toby Jones and Simon McBurney from Complicité people like that. So I went there for 2 years, and it just swung my whole life around. It was like, the most fantastic experience.
What was the, what changed?
I suppose I was in my mid-20s then, and I had a reasonable amount of maturity and experience under my belt. Well, the Queensland Theatre Company where I'd worked, they financially got me out of a bit of a hole because I lived in a state of penury while I was there. And they offered me $1,000, which was a lot of money in 1976, to help with my second-year fees.
Wow.
With the proviso that by 1980, which was so far into the future, in my, it was almost George Orwell territory, you know. I thought, take the money. They said, as long as by 1980, come back and work on salary for 6 months and take some classes from what you've learned being at this school in Paris and everything. And the following year, they did a production of King Lear with this, well, he's famous, just recently, sadly passed, Warren Mitchell, who was in this groundbreaking sitcom in Britain in the 60s called Till Death Us Do Part, which became All in the Family in America with Carol
O'Connor.
Yeah. Very brazen, sharply written, you know, dangerously political and, you know, and the bigot at the heart of it was a great figure of fun. So he wanted to do King Lear, and I went back and played the fool to him. And I just had the most fantastic time. And that play then took me to Sydney, and it played well. And I thought I was going to come back and work with some of my colleagues in Europe and set up our own small theater ensemble or whatever. But, you know, 13 years later, I'm still working in Australia. And
what had happened in Australia while you had been in England and France, I guess, was that they had now started slowly to have a film industry, right?
They did. They did, yeah.
And so when you came back, was that what kept you there in a way? Were you already getting into films?
I went straight back to the theater. I was so thrilled because I'd seen, you know, Peter Weir's early films, Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Last Wave, which are, you know, they're Australian masterpieces, I think.
And maybe the Fred Skepsy stuff.
And Fred Skepsy as well, you know. But I never identified or saw myself as a film actor. And, you know, it could have been a lot of what we were doing at that stage was exploring the kind of debate between, you know, with something like The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, it was the debate between our First Nation Indigenous population and the white settlement from 200 years before. There was a lot of pioneering of the white settlement type films, and I thought, I'm not the kind of guy to have my shirt off riding bareback on a horse, you know. And I was doing so well in the theatre, I was kind of, you know, working in regular long-term contracts, three-year contracts, two-year contracts in ensembles and stuff.
Well, I want to ask you, like, if you can contextualize for somebody who wasn't there, doesn't know how the Australian theater world worked at that point. If there was a parallel in the United States, would you have been a guy who was constantly working on Broadway, or was it more regional stuff?
Well, not so much Broadway, more like you'd be working maybe like at the Lincoln Center. This would be high-end, you know, prestigious, state-funded, federally funded theater companies. But the commercial arena has always been very strong in Australia for musical theatre. And at the moment, you know, some major revivals, like a colleague of mine is currently in My Fair Lady, which will end up on Broadway because Julie Andrews has directed it.
Oh, wow.
And the sort of wellspring of musical theatre talent is massive in that country. So sometimes they'll do something like Hairspray, but it won't necessarily be the blueprint of the Broadway show. It'll be reinvented with design or whatever. And sometimes it'll be Jersey Boys, and it will be right down to the micro piece of choreography that is, you know, carefully reproduced from the brilliance of the original and so forth.
But the reason I ask is that when in 1996 Shine came along and sort of put you on the international map, the way it was often, I think, reported was that here's this guy who's been a jobbing actor 25 years. The impression was that, you know, you had been kind of scraping out a living doing this. But in fact, you've been a pretty successful actor in Australia, right?
Well, successful in the sense that it was always personally rewarding for me because I got to know a number of key long-term directors that I've had relationships with over now 20, 25, 30 years. So I was always constantly in work. It was never... I know when my daughter was born in 93, I thought, wow, education fees, where are they going to come from? You know, and there was just that fortuitous timing. Not that the fee for Shine was, well, compared to a theatre wage, I sort of went, wow, this is, I'm Scrooge McDuck now. I'm in the money bin, you know.
Well, let's step back though for a second because when, so were you content with your career as a, working at a quite high level regularly in Australia, actor?
Yeah. Look, I was able to play a broad repertoire and it was very satisfying because I kind of had a reputation and I was ticking off within the Shakespearean canon all of the, I rarely do the big verse heroic roles like a Hamlet, never done that, never done the Scottish play. I did do Lear a year or two ago. I was in that outer concentric circle of all the idiots and ratbags and fools and drunks that Shakespeare wrote.
Right.
And they are great roles.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Sir Andrew Aguecheek in Twelfth Night and Thersites in Troilus and Cressida or Autolycus in A Winter's Tale. So I was getting to play them all over the country and having a really kind of fun time.
So what were the panic attacks about that I heard when you're around when you turn 40, before Shine, you having a kid? You were having literally panic attacks.
Probably
right?
Turning 40.
Turning 40. Really?
I don't know. I think I might have overstretched. Do you know what I mean? We were doing a production. My wife was in it. We were doing a production of The Importance of Being Earnest. And that's probably as close as I got to what was near what you might call a commercial production. Mm-hmm. It had the woman playing Lady Bracknell was a very famous actress and famous on television. And the guy who played both Lane and Merriman, the two butlers, mm-hmm. was a fantastic comic actor. He'd been working in New York for decades. And so they were very big star names. Mind you, Jack Worthing is actually the biggest role in the show, but that's all right. The print on the poster was kind of blotting itself out. It was so tiny.
Oh, you're saying of your credit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not bitter. Yeah, and we went on a national tour, so we were working hard, you know, and it's eight times a week and everything. And just one night, you know, on stage, I had this kind of wave where I went, it's like a wave of terror where you go, is this stage fright? I don't think so. I feel comfortable and everything. It just sort of hit me. And then I spoke to a lot of, you know, I went to a behavioral therapist and I went and did transcendental meditation and all this sort of stuff. And I started to meet many other people within the profession and from other professions who go, yeah, just an anxiety attack, panic attack.
Right.
You're not dying. You think you are. You hyperventilate.
And then it went away?
It faded over a period of time. And, you know, but it was the behavioral therapist I found most interesting. I didn't think it had anything to do with my parents splitting up when I was five. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't really feel like going down that Freudian path. I didn't feel as though that was the core of it.
Right.
And he said, the fact that you went back on stage the next night is part of the therapy because...
Just face
you'll
it.
Learn that you'll desensitize.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be you'll go. There's nothing to panic about.
And
know?
So that's long gone.
Way past.
Yeah. So how did you first hear about the story of this pianist David Helfgott, and how did the idea of a film, again for somebody who had not at that point done many films, if any,
I'd done two films in which the size of the role, my friend. Dear long-time friend used to say, is as big as the third rat on the coach in Cinderella.
So that's a good way of putting it. So here you go. Where did this come from?
Well, the casting director, I'd spent a lot of time in Adelaide in a regional company. It was kind of the go-to place to get away from the big city where everyone was clambering to get into films. And it had a great reputation as like, I don't know what it would be like. Steppenwolf in Chicago. Everyone goes, it's got its own identity. Yeah. It's strong. And like, you know, sometimes shows tour from there, but there's a kind of artistry to it. Or the Worcester Group or something. You know what I mean? And the woman who was the casting director of Shine had seen me a lot in theater, as had the director, Scott Hicks. So they just offered me the part, and I read the script and thought, wow, somehow this is the first time I've read a screenplay where I went, this could be my territory. Not because I'd played Ratbags and I'd played the fool in Lear, but there was something about, and then I met David, and I went, his sense of otherness in the world seemed to match those sort of outer concentric circle characters that I'd been playing. You know, I hardly ever hovered to the heroic point at the center of the story, you know. And it was an impeccably written screenplay, and I found it very moving and everything. And
were you surprised to be offered this?
Well, I went in and did screen tests with Scott, and even then he was playing around with, could his hands be, could we do, you know, puppetry kind of things. And I said, I think if I, you know, if I take this role on, you know, I'd at least learn to mime the piano really well. But of course, what happened is that fate entered. It took 3 years. Every 3 months, I'd get a phone call saying, we can't get the finance together. We're postponing for a while, you know, another 3 months. And then my daughter was born. So I took time off and I thought, I'm waiting for this film because it's worth waiting for. It
just and were feels... you doing things to prep? Were there things you could be doing?
Well, yes. I mean, I spent a lot of time. Scott had given me hours and hours of interviews that he'd done with David in researching the biography of his life. And I wrote all of these interviews out as I wanted to see what they looked like in script form. And that was an illumination because all of the kind of curious minefield of wordplay and thoughts that go through David's head that comes out in his kind of natural babble, enthusiasm for life, it just was so fascinating. So I had time to look at that, and then I had time to start working with a piano tutor. And we didn't get the green light till early 1995, so it was close on 3 years. So I put that to good use, and for the first time I wasn't booked up doing 8 plays a year in a held-together repertory kind of scene all over the country, and I was occasionally then available to do a new David Mamet play with a young Kate Blanchett, and, you know, at 3 weeks' notice. I said, yeah, I can do that. I'm free. I have nothing on.
So how early on, once you'd gone to work on the movie, did you realize that this was something that was really working? And then even in your wildest dreams, did you imagine that this could take on the life that it did internationally?
No idea whatsoever. No idea. We thought, oh, look, it's a really interesting story. Is there an audience out there, even in Australia, who will be interested in, let's say, a central character with a slightly aberrant personality who marries an older woman and he's a classical pianist? Yeah, people might go, yeah, you know, it's just not my cup of tea or whatever. So Australian films had often beaten the path to Cannes. That was where... and at that, around that time, it's when, you know, Jane Campion, who we claim is Australasian, that won Palme d'Or at Cannes with the piano.
Yeah, like 2 years earlier or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. But for some reason, they raced the print, literally wet from the lab, and they got it into Sundance, which wasn't a conventional path. And I was doing a TV series at that time over a period of 6 months. And do you remember those old phone fax machines where you'd feed in kind of shellacked, what looked like shellacked public toilet newsprint? Do you know what I mean?
I think I know what you mean. Telefax. So,
because my agent said, you've got to get a fax. Yeah. You know, we can send you messages and, you know, you can sign things and then send them back. And I kept getting these messages from Scott Hicks, and he said, the film has just opened at Sundance, and middle-aged men are staggering from the theatre sobbing.
Wow.
And I went, what do you mean? He said, it's just, you could feel it in the house. I got the rhythm right. he is in the story. Yeah, he said, I couldn't believe the emotional tidal wave that was going through the audience. And then there was some sort of bidding war that involved Harvey Weinstein, and I think Park City was snowed in that year or whatever. And they put it under wraps because they wanted to release it. Fine Line got a hold of the film with a passion, because that's where, you know, these subsidiary mini-majors, as they called them, mm-hmm. were starting to blossom.
Yeah.
And they were looking for, you know, an alternative to Off Independence beat, Day or whatever.
Yeah, right. Counter-programming, out. And you, so that began this year, I guess, maybe even just over a year, of constant back and forth to America, and your profile blew up and all of that, right?
They said, yeah, can you come over and do some publicity? And I said, yeah, that would be fun. I've got nothing to lose. And we came over and went to the Mill Valley Film Festival, which was gorgeous, and then down to the New Orleans Film Festival and Chicago, and then we did a press junket in New York, and then I went home, you know, and then 2 weeks later they'd say, we can get bigger and better.
Right.
Outlets now, people are really liking the film, and it was in, I think, the Angelica Center in Lincoln, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Lincoln that was Plaza. And meanwhile, people are starting to actually recognize you.
There was a moment on that first visit where I was at some fabulous Italian restaurant down on like 12th Street or something. I was outside having a cigarette, and this guy walked past and said, hey, loved your movie. And I went, wow. Some student-y looking guy, and I thought, I'm kind of a Sydney theater actor, and I'm standing on the streets of New York, and this guy says that to me. And then 2 weeks later, I came back again, and another student-y guy came up and said, hey, you're Jeffrey Rush, aren't you? You know, I loved you in the film Shine, you know. Great. Another 2 weeks, I go back home, and they said, come back, we can get you on some big talk shows and stuff like that. And I came back, and there was a guy who was a cleaner at the airport, and he looked across, and he went, hey, Piano Man. And I thought, this is insane.
Right.
You know, it was sort of like a really interesting human scale gradation of how the film was.
I wish you kept the diary of that year. Maybe you did.
In my head, maybe, you know.
So let's just cap that topic by asking, you go into the Oscar night. Having been nominated itself must have been a big deal. Did you go in thinking that you were going to leave with the Oscar that night?
No. I just went, well, I don't know what the statistics are, but I'm one of five nominees.
Right.
You never know from the Academy. They're a pretty august body. They keep a nice, tight control. Yeah. Well, apart from this year. No. I thought, I don't know. I had no idea, and I just thought, I'm in the most amazing company. There's Ralph Fiennes, there's Tom Cruise, there's Woody Harrelson, you know what I mean, in my category.
Yeah.
And Billy Bob, you know. So you kind of go, this is a sweet spot to be, you know. But also, because of the film had opened in Australia in 1996, I think it was around April, and did the festival, the Brisbane Film Festival, Melbourne Film Festival, Sydney Film Festival. So, you know, it was a year later, and I'd sort of every day, every waking hours, would seem to be a connection with going out and flogging the product of Shine.
Well, it was near the beginning of this era of like the modern Oscar campaign and whatever. Everybody now, it's gotten even crazier, right?
Yep.
So, but I mean, the good news is that without the Oscars, who knows if they'd even make these kinds of movies, you know. It seems like the rest of the year is pretty.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah,
but you are part of that all the time. And from September the year before, I was used to just, you know, talking about that film. You know, some awards came out, you know, print awards, and you go to that luncheon, and they weren't even televised in those days.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then the Globes, and then the SAGs, and so you kind of. And it was generally a very interesting party atmosphere, because that's where I first met Emily Watson.
Right.
You know, she was there with Breaking the Waves.
Right.
And I used to hang out with Billy Bob and do joint interviews, because they thought well, two of you might be more interesting than
the two new kids on the block.
The guy from Queensland and the guy from Arkansas. That was the
thing. Odd couple, right?
So by the time you get there on the night of that ceremony, it's you kind of know your way around the protocol.
Right.
Or, you know, it's not like it just suddenly happens.
Right.
In front of you. So,
did the win itself change anything?
I could tell by the things that my agent, who I was with already since June the year before,
yeah,
he'd seen a screening of the film when it was under wraps and everything, and literally came to Australia to visit a client who was working on a film down there, but came to meet me and, you know, saying, I want to represent you. And I thought, wow, you've flown across the Pacific Ocean to do this. No one else has done that, you know.
Right.
It was, and it's still going strong.
Nice.
But, you know, one of the first films I was offered after that was Liberace.
They just wanted another piano.
They had another piano genre. That was going to be my thing. And I thought, no.
Better to avoid that.
So I went and did this, you know, very smart, I thought smart screenplay adaptation of Victor Hugo's novel Les Miserables, mm-hmm. directed by Billy August. And Rafael Iglesias had done a really smart kind of, because it's a sprawling book and it's, you know, to get a cinema narrative out of it is complicated. It kind of came and went, unfortunately. But for me, it was, I thought, I got nothing to lose, because if this doesn't work out, and then a couple of, you know, good projects came along, Shakespeare in Love and Elizabeth, and they were really, I love that period of history, and it felt like I was still kind of mentally in my kind of inspiring theatrical space. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of playing the guy who ran the Rose Theatre was like a Shakespearean character in Tom Stoppard. I had written impeccable,
yeah,
beautiful dialogue for it and stuff like that.
You bring up the Elizabethan, your Elizabethan era, because you had not just Shakespeare in Love, but also Elizabeth in the same year, one sort of comedy, one is sort of a drama. Just coincidental that you did those both around the same time, or?
Totally coincidental. Yeah. They kind of happened. Elizabeth came up as a script, and I was filming in Prague at the time, and Shekhar Kapoor came over, because I'd sort of said, I don't know if I really want to play this particular part. Mm-hmm. I wasn't being picky or anything. I just thought, gee, a spy master, it's not normally my territory. I was, you know, hopefully looking for something with a comic slant to it, or that sense of otherness or whatever.
You know?
But he came over and it was a really illuminating pitch about how he, as a subcontinental, raised in England, Indian, you know, how he saw the film working.
And was that your first time with Kate?
And it was, and it was so unlike what I imagine a British director would have done.
Right.
You know, and I always said this is, and then when Kate was cast in it and I'd worked with her, and that just seemed so strangely coincidental, because we'd worked in the theatre couple of times, you know, and I said to Shaker, well, this is, you know, this is, when I saw the final cut of the film, I went, this is the Revenge of the Colonies. You know?
And then with Shakespeare in Love, this is, I guess, the first of two Best Picture collaborations with Colin Firth. So what was the...
It was, that's right.
Yeah, so, and what, something like 14 years apart? That was. Did you guys...
Something like that.
Well, so what was... Did you... I have to ask, because again, here's one that did not, I think, start with a massive profile and then ends up winning the Oscar. No, I mean, what was your...
My agent in Sydney said, come in, I've got a really interesting script, and Tom Stoppard's done the most recent draft of it. And I went, oh, great, that sounds very interesting. And I'm sitting there reading. I got to, like, page 5. The character enters right at the beginning. And I just looked up and I said, I have to be in this. It just felt like...
So you saw it.
A gold mine in my hands. You know what I mean? The dialogue was laugh out loud funny. It was smart. But even in making it, everyone went, well, you know, it's got great cast, and Judi Dench is playing Queen Elizabeth I and Joe Fiennes and, you know, all these great, Gwyneth Paltrow, and it was just an amazing company.
Yeah.
But we all, and all the boys that played the troupe at the Rose Theatre, we were in there a lot. And we said, well, you know, do you think it's going to keep the title Shakespeare in Love? I can't imagine Harvey wanting the word Shakespeare into this. But, you know, hopefully it'll be a nice little smart art house release, you know.
Right.
We had no big high grand hopes for it. And I remember at the time we'd say, well, you know, if he doesn't want Shakespeare in the title, we kept coming up with alternate titles like Goodwill Humping. And right. There was another one where some guy, yeah, what about the Full Montague? I can't remember. There were others.
Those are all the year before those two movies.
It was hilarious for us. And then it became a date movie, you know.
And was it really also driven by, in terms of winning all these awards, which raised the profile and probably made it a movie people wanted to see, was that, seems like it may have been driven by fellow actors. I remember SAG was the first one that really signed on in a way. They gave you guys their ensemble award, which is their equivalent of Best Picture. It just seems like actors loved watching a movie about actors done by actors who looked like they were having a good time.
Yeah, maybe. I can never kind of...
Postmortem them.
I can never pick. I mean, I was so thrilled for Moonlight, because that film knocked me sideways when I saw it. I went, this is masterpiece cinema. You know, like you are really watching something so amazingly written, performed, confrontational, stimulating.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't even want to pull apart what were the ingredients. You just go, you just say to other people, don't miss this film and don't read anything about it before you go. Try and have a virginal experience with it, you know.
It seems like one that almost got away would have been Quills, which I know is another big one in your list there of many. Why did you essentially try to get out of that one?
Well, initially, I had a fantastic meeting with Phil Kaufman, and I was the biggest fan of The Right Stuff. I think it's just one of the great American films. And I'd loved the Tom Wolfe book and was passionate about my involvement with the Mercury space program from when I was 10. That ties up to why I wanted to play Einstein
in
a funny kind of way. But I said to him, look, it's the script, it's Doug Wright, it's like dense, beautiful, and scurrilous kind of writing. He's a brilliant wit. And he gave me the original play as to see where it had come from and everything. And I said, but, you know, in 1808, the Marquis de Sade was obese and he was, like, huge. And I said, it's not my role, you know. You need get a great actor like Brando and he'll eat this alive, you know. And Phil said, no. Doug's idea for this is that the Marquis de Sade, locked up in this kind of insane asylum, sees himself as the rakish hero of his own novels. There's a certain degree of narcissism in that. And I said, oh, okay, all right. It was, again, one of those roles that would normally be outer concentric circle in the story. And I always think about that. I go, when I was doing that film, I thought the abbe is the heroic, tragic figure in the middle of it. And I'm just the guy that whirls around like Neptune or Pluto or something. You know what I mean?
Right. But I guess even when you're playing a smaller part, you approach it as if you're the main character, right? You still have to do all the same work.
Yeah. I only count the lines to see if the task is going to be, is my memory going to be up to this?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because sometimes on film days you go, today I've got a 5-page monologue, you know what I mean, whatever.
You had quite a bit of that with Genius. Mm. But last few before Genius is just, after all these art house movies that we're talking about here, you end up, of all things, in Pirates of the Caribbean, which clearly stands out as a different sort of movie. And you look like, I think we're now coming up on, you've just finished the fifth.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered, is it fun? Is it a different sort of acting that you're called upon to have to do in these? Or do you treat it the same?
I treat it the same. I mean, there was just something after two Elizabethan films and yet again wearing, a powdered wig in Quills. I thought, I've got to get out of tights. I think this is going to be a dead end career if I don't get out of tight soon. But you know, in a way, Barbossa does wear stockings. You know what I mean? That's why when Mystery Men came along, I really leapt at that because I just went, any film that's got a character called Casanova Frankenstein, you just go.
You got to jump on it.
Get on board, and it did have an extraordinary cast. And I'm pleased to hear online now occasionally people go into a bit of a fan rave about it's a forgotten masterpiece, or it was their favorite film when they were at high school or whatever. You know,
people that are going to be seeing Genius, there may be assumption that Geoffrey Rush is going to television, that they need to go back and refresh on the life and death of Peter Sellers, which was you going to do television before it was the cool thing to do. Now everybody, it seems like all the best actors want to go and do.
Yeah.
But at that time, did it feel like, you know, it seems like for a long time there was this attitude that if you've made it in films, it's a backward step to go to TV. That's all gone. But when you did Life and Death of Peter Sellers in 2004, did you feel like that was a risky move?
No, because, well, I know, look, HBO was at the top of their game, and the creative team, Colin Callender was the head guy, and the whole office was filled with bright, sharp-minded people, passionate about pushing the envelope, you know, as it were. But because of its format, I mean, it went in other territories. It went out in cinemas, but it exclusively went out on HBO in the States only, I think, you know. But I always thought of it as, you know, well, it's a sort of movie that's playing in the cinemas, but it's going to be on TV, and they would say to me, you know, we've got X million subscribers, and it means if they all watch it, you'll have a $2 billion opening weekend, as it were. You know what I mean?
Like it's
they knew who and where and what their audience particularly was, and that now, of course, is like it's mushroomed in terms of, you know, even Nat Geo is now moving into scripted drama, and the History Channel is doing
peak
the
TV, right? Everybody's doing scripted stuff. But one last movie to ask you before we finally get to Genius here, which is that with the King's Speech, again, back with Colin Firth, but this time it's really the two of you, I guess, for the most part, almost all of your scenes. First of all, the way you got it, I think, is kind of a amazing story, right? It just like comes over the wall. Comes over the fence.
it was in a brown paper bag on my welcome mat in front of my home in the suburbs of Melbourne. And the woman who had the play script, as it was originally, was part of a fringe theatre group, I think, in the north of London. She had a best friend who lived in my neighbourhood. And she wrote a cover letter and said, sorry to be so audacious, but have a read of this. And I went, oh, okay. And there was an Australian speech therapist was the character, and they were interested in the play, you know.
They wanted you to join their play.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, that's kind of good. An Australian character in a kind of international story. I couldn't think of many other immediate examples, apart from Tropic Thunder. Where I think Robert Downey Jr. might have been basing that on an Australasian identity, shall we say.
We'll have to look into that, yes.
No, I read it, and to be honest, I wasn't that taken by the play. It had huge, ambitious ideas in it, but it was almost reaching for a Shakespearean scale, you know, involving Winston Churchill and the Archbishop of Canterbury and the royal household and all of that. And I read it and I thought, this could be... I thought the relationship between the speech therapist and the Duke of York. I sent it to my LA agent and I said, I don't know who would write this. Maybe the author who's done it could. I said, I think that's the story. You know what I mean? Not that you lose those other characters, but it just felt as though that was the heart of it. And David Seidler did, you know, he adapted it into a screenplay, and then Tom Hooper came on board. And I'd met Tom at an HBO do. I seemed to be welcomed socially into the HBO family, and I got invited to a dinner in LA.
Right.
And it happened to be Helen Mirren was just opening with Jeremy Irons in the long form version of Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Tom had directed some of that, or maybe all of it. I just happened to be sitting next to him at dinner, and we got on terribly well. And then some years later, his name came up, and he said, "I'm really interested in this story," because he has an Australian mother.
And at this time, even though you're into the script and you're into the character and all that, there wasn't that much known about this guy that you were going to play Lionel.
Nothing. I Googled him and found one minor reference on the history page of the Australian Speech Therapists Association website. One glimpse of a reference. And then my uncle, who was a doctor and had studied medicine, he remembers. He said, "I remember we learnt about Lionel Logue in second year when we were dealing with anatomy or the tongue or something like that, and there was a passing reference." But the one that knocked me sideways was at some ceremony or at some awards night, I think. I was introduced in passing as Rupert Murdoch was leaving the room, and they told me, or one of his minders told me the story that he'd asked, what films are around at the moment? What should I go and see? You know, and they mentioned the King's Speech. What's it about? Oh, it's about this Australian speech therapist. And he went, "Oh, Lionel Logue." Because Lionel Logue had treated his father, Keith Murdoch, for a childhood stammer, you know.
Oh, my God.
And I know, it's crazy.
That's crazy. And what was even crazier was the way that you ended up getting the information, like a lot of information about this guy
Did you hear that loud noise then with all those names I was dropping on the floor?
Rupert Murdoch, that's all right. Racket. He's Aussie. It's all in the family. That's okay. But basically just right before you go to work, it all poured in,
literally,
right?
I thought I will have to invent this character and do what, you know, a speculative history for him. Where did he grow up? What were his likes? What did he look like? We'll have to make this up and find the credibility that he got to work with the king and everything. And then we spent about 3 or 4 weeks, Colin and the writer and myself and Tom, in a hotel room, and we were just inching and working through the script and road testing, because there were scenes that were 10 pages long. Two middle-aged men sitting in a room talking, one of whom stutters, and you go, is this what movies are about?
Is it going to work? Yeah.
And then one day Tom came in and said, "We've had this gold mine unearthed that one of Lionel's grandchildren, I think, had got in touch with the art department and said, I've got all his diaries, personally written diaries and photographs and stuff." And it was just such a wealth of information.
Amazing.
And a lot of that then got woven into the story. I mean, David Sidler had done his homework, and he used to tell me the story that he had written very politely to the Queen Mother to say, "Can I have your blessing to write this play?" And she said, "Not while I'm alive, please."
Wow.
It's such a painful kind of memory for her.
Well, there was an instance, as was Peter Sellers, where you're playing a person who actually lived but was no longer around to consult. Here it comes again with Einstein. And I guess as far as genius, we've established you had an early interest in science. And did you go after this, or did they come after? How did this come about that you ended up, again, not only back on TV, but in actually a format that I don't think was one that – had you ever done something as long as 10 hours with one character?
I had, back in 1980 – I did a 12-part series for our national broadcaster. But in those days, no one used the words limited
form,
they just went TV series, you know. They called a spade in those days. And this was, it was about three priests working in a kind of social work environment in their community. And I played the young, you know, Catholic priest who had a big interest in Buddhism and all that. And then there was a crusty old Monsignor, and then there was a radical young guy that was out there trying to bring out the orthodoxies of the church into a kind of community outreach service, you know. It was okay. It did well. And then I did another one in the mid-90s, the one I talked about when I was – Shine was playing at the festival in Sundance. And that was about a broadsheet Sunday newspaper, you know, whatever the equivalent of the New York Sunday Times is, that sort of thing. And I was the editor, and it was a 12-part thing. That was great for me because that was just after I'd done 3 Australian films in a row, and I thought, gee, I better get a lot more experience with the camera. And this came up, and I thought 6 months of that.
Yeah.
And pounding out an episode every 2 weeks or something. And I thought, this is going to be a really good training ground. So I didn't really, and I was so aware that good writing was coming out of, you know, and the first episode that I read, written by Noah Pink, I just thought, this crackles.
This first
something.
Episode of Genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This really crackles. It's not academic and stuffy. It's whatever Nat Geo is doing to rebrand themselves in their first foray into scripted drama.
Yeah.
They seem to be doing it really well.
Yeah.
And Ron is an he does an enthusiastic pitch as well that's very articulate and very exciting. You get caught up in the vortex of his enthusiasm for making something that's imaginative and got good storytelling and is going to inspire audiences to have their imaginations put on high alert, you know. So it was an offer. And then Johnny Flynn, fabulous, mm-hmm. my doppelganger,
yeah.
you know, he got that role a week later or something. I think they were trying to find the right actorial DNA to get these two guys to credibly create.
And were you guys seeing each other as you did this? Was there coordination?
We started speaking to each other on Skype because I was in Melbourne and he was in the UK. I said, you know, look, we know he's a scientist, so that's going to happen. You know, that's what he does. We're going to see him do lectures, and we're going to see him do this, and we're going to see him writing on blackboards and everything. So we started talking. I said, you know, they sent me this Vimeo package of pretty much every bit of newsreel footage of older Einstein that existed. And there was one fabulous bit where you just see him getting off a boat, carrying his violin case with the hat, looking like some kind of Yiddish bohemian poet, you know. And I ran that idea past Johnny, and he said, yeah, I know. It's like I'm getting that. It's like I'm getting he'd then send me a photograph of Bob Dylan in the 1960s going, I'm getting this sort of feel mm-hmm. from him as well mm-hmm. because he was such a rebellious, anti-authoritarian young man. And even at the age of 16 or 17, he turned in his German passport because he wanted to be a citizen of the world. And that's radical behavior for, you know, in the 1890s. So, yeah, we were just bouncing around these kinds of ideas, and we looked at, you know, transitional moments. But because the story is by no means told in a strictly linear fashion, it's not cradle to grave. It jumps around, not unlike Einstein's theory of relativity.
Right.
You move around this man's life and look at it from whatever viewpoint, certain thematic, dramatic threads will tie it together.
Well, you know? And there are people that hear science or Einstein or things related to that, and maybe their tendency throughout their life has been their eyes sort of glaze over a little bit. But in this case, you guys deal with that from the first scene where we see you, where it's like, this is not your guy who's, you know, just pictured in the Think Different ads or whatever. You're having sex with your secretary, and that's how you meet Albert Einstein.
I know. Well, that's thanks to Ken Biller, the showrunner, and maybe Ron. I know Ron was determined that within the first 4 minutes, people should be on the edge of their seat going, this is working.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to Ken at some point, I can't think who made this quote, was in some book about filmmaking that I read earlier. It might have even come from Pauline Kael or somebody like that. You know, a good film starts with a fuck or a fight. And Ken said last night when we were doing the Q&A, he said, we did both.
Right, that's right. That's
so it starts with a political assassination of a high-standing German member of parliament who's a close friend of Einstein's. It's two German Jews, you know. And then the second scene after that is, yes, he is having it off with his secretary Betty
right.
Neumann.
Right.
Which is historically accurate. And his wife, Elsa, was aware of his extramarital infidelities.
Who knew he had such a... Mm. Right. So in the last minute here, I just... 2 questions are going to bring this back to you, but through Einstein here, I want to... So the idea of genius, the title of this show, which is going to apparently continue into other geniuses after this. I mean, What does that word even mean to you? Have you encountered in your own travels a genius?
Part of my preparation was to do a bit of reading around what people over history had said, because it's a, I don't know, probably in the States and Britain. In Australia, you know, people will call a lemon meringue pie genius. You know, it gets applied to food.
Right.
I'm not a big sports fanatic, but a friend of mine told me this when he knew that I was playing Einstein. He said, there was this Australian rules football commentator saying once, people are using the word genius about all the members of the footy teams. You know, see the way he kicked that goal, that was genius. See the way he took that mark, that was genius. He said, you can't use genius like that. Genius can only be applied to guys like that Norman Einstein. I don't know why I find that
that's hilarious.
Hilarious, but right. it's great. No, so I landed on one just through Googling, going, what is genius? And, you know, you read all this stuff, and then you read about the development of IQ testing and screeds of stuff about that. But it was Schopenhauer, and I went, great, German philosopher. This will have the voice of authority.
Right.
But it is, you know, it's the thing that could be on a bumper sticker on the back of a car, and it could be on a coffee cup, it could be on a desk calendar, but it's an aphorism that I thought, that's it.
Right.
And he says, talent hits a target that no one else can hit. You know, and you go, yeah, musician, sportsman, I know what you're talking about. Genius hits a target no one else can see.
And that's
that's Einstein.
Right,
because he was such a lateral thinker, a daydreamer, thinking outside the box, as we used to say, you know.
Yeah.
And coming up with revolutionary new perceptions.
It's amazing. And finally, he attained his fame and applause at an unusually young age.
He was 26.
For his profession. Mm. You waited a little longer to become as a very famous, widely revered person for what you did in your profession. Having seen what it was like for him studying this character and having known what it was like for you, are you happy it was that way, or would you have liked to have experienced it the way that he did?
No, I knew in my 20s that, I'd had kind of older mentors that said to me, you know, maybe in your 40s, that's where you'll mature as a character actor, because you'll have more experience under your belt and everything. I knew that I wasn't part of the Juve lead territory. Do you know what I mean? I was playing old men when I was 23. up to a point. I've pitched the idea to Nat Geo that if they continue this as a series, I said, why don't you... Even if we only come back in incidental cameo roles, keep Sam Colley, this brilliant young British actress who plays Maleva Maric, and Johnny and Emily and Vincent Cartier, mm-hmm. and all these amazing people who are in it. So keep them in the ensemble, which I gather they do
American Horror Story.
Yeah. So I said, whatever you do for the next one, you know, I'll
you'd come back.
I'll come back and just do one scene, if it, not to play Einstein, but just to be somebody in there.
Cause that's cool.
I think it would be interesting.
Absolutely.
Because I said, don't do my life story, because that would be a series called More On.
Well, this idea sounds genius. So they'll have to do that. But anyway, thanks very much for doing this. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, mate.